Welcome to the Money Maze Podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. Over the last 2 years, we've released two mini-series on private markets, seeking to understand how the growth of private equity, alternative assets and supporting industries are disrupting the wider investment management sector. We wanted to probe how much of the enthusiasm and growth was cyclical and powered by cheap money rather than a structural force creating a permanent component of asset allocations. In light of the upcoming release of our third private market mini-series, we've compiled some of the highlights from last season with fascinating experts from individuals behind the likes of IFM Investors, NASDAQ Private Markets, TPG Next, Tiger Howe Capital, and Case. David Neal, CEO of IFM Investors, discussed the long-term benefits and characteristics of infrastructure as an institutional asset class. But just starting at the high level, infrastructure as an asset class, who does it suit best and why?
Well, I think infrastructure is, you know, I'm obviously talking my own book here, but it is, in many ways, it just feels like almost the perfect institutional asset class. In private wealth, really, anybody who has a long-term desire to generate high risk-adjusted returns. And the reason for that is that it has wonderful long-term characteristics. At its heart, nearly all the cash flows that underpin an infrastructure asset are inflation-related in some way. So they may be contractually inflation-related. So many, often utilities have a CPI-linked cash flow form, or they're implicitly inflation-related. So growth assets like airports or toll roads and things will often have some element of inflation linkage within them as well. So you can be confident that over a very long period of time, your purchasing power is maintained, which at the end of the day is the first and most important objective of long-term investing. There's no point investing for the long term and then finding that your purchasing power has declined. So that level of confidence that you have that you're going to get a strong real return, I think, is absolutely critical over the long term. And these are long-term assets. So they are, you know, we're buying concessions or leases over 50, 60 years or more. So again, you can have confidence that the money that you've invested is going to generate those kind of returns over those kind of periods. And that's really critical. It also has obviously this wonderful characteristic of they're essential assets. So they're still going to be generating returns, still going to be generating cash flows. The customers still need to use these assets even in tough economic times. So they're very resilient to economic downturns. They're not infallible. So people might choose to drive on the toll road less often when times are tough, when there's less disposable income around, but they're still likely to be driving on the toll road. Certainly trucks are still using the toll road to distribute goods and so on. So you're still getting a pretty strong level of resilience to the cash flows that are produced. So you've got this confidence in long-term real returns and a very high level of resilience through short-term cycles.
And high barriers to entry, I presume, because these are very large numbers.
Absolutely. Well, the barriers to entry are almost the definition of infrastructure. You know, the point of it is being an essential asset is that it's very unlikely that there'll be another one built alongside it because, you know, you only need one utility, one water utility for that area, one toll road that connects those two towns. So the nature of infrastructure is that there's an extremely high barriers to entry. There's also barriers to entry to investing within it as well. So it's not the easiest asset class for someone to just enter into. These are extremely complex businesses that require, obviously, the skills and resources to not only buy but manage well.
IFM has been investing in Australian infrastructure since 1995, I think, achieving fantastic results. Has there been a particular winner that stands out? Has it been, because of the nature of the beast, quite predictable? And where have you made a decision that, with hindsight, you wouldn't do again?
I mean, certainly the dispersion is low. Again, it comes back to the nature of these asset classes. They are generally, all of the assets are generally pretty resilient. The huge test for that we've just been through, where the dispersion for a while there did get much larger, was, of course, the pandemic. And in a way, it was a phenomenal test for true diversification in a portfolio. And I believe a really good example of why long-term investing through large, diversified, open-ended funds is a really attractive way to approach this asset class. Because who could have predicted that the revenues for one of your subsectors would drop to zero in what is supposed to be a highly resilient asset class? But of course, in a pandemic, airports became parking lots for planes and there was no revenue, literally no revenue. Nobody was parking in the car parks. Nobody was in the shops. Nobody was taking off on airplanes. So these places just went to zero. And it's very hard for any risk model to kind of predict that sort of thing. So you'd think that that would be a disaster for an infrastructure portfolio, that kind of environment. But of course, what we did as a population, as humans, was because we couldn't move ourselves, we just ended up moving stuff instead. So goods started being sent around. Every day, our doorbell went, and there was another package outside for something that we'd ordered. So there was a shift in our habits, and it just meant that instead, the infrastructure that allows goods to move did very well, whilst the infrastructure that moves people did not so well. And when you put the two of those things together, the overall effect on a portfolio that was properly diversified was that it actually sailed through remarkably unscathed. You asked, what would we not have done? There's always kind of lessons here and there about that you learn. You know, this is not a job that you can ever be perfect in. But I think, as ever, the most important lesson that is emphasized time and again is diversification. I do believe in not being overly scientific about diversification, because you can't predict things like pandemics and their potential effect. So just being broadly spread across sectors, broadly spread across types of cash flows, is always the lesson from these sorts of events.
Next, an excerpt from our conversation with Tom Callahan, CEO of NASDAQ Private Markets, on the lack of exits and liquidity within the private business space and their mission to address that and to help create liquidity where it doesn't exist. So unlike a normal IPO process where an investment bank will be charged with establishing a valuation range and then going out and, you know, marketing, et cetera, in this case, you, NASDAQ Private Markets, are not in that price, ascertaining the price. You are in putting buyers and sellers together and verifying data and providing the analytics and assisting the technology.
We're not an investment bank. We're not a research operation. We're a trading platform. And so we don't set price. We create efficient markets, and then the markets then set those prices.
And other than employees, aren't the great beneficiaries of this the venture capitalists?
It can be, for sure. I'd say primarily, there's sort of two ways that the private market securities trade. The first is the one that I just described, where the company is our client, and we're running a tender program on behalf of their employees. Now, sometimes early round investors are able to sell, but usually it's focused on employees. There's another part of our business where the shareholder themselves is the client. We call that the block market. Now, who could the shareholder be? It could be a current employee, it could be a former employee, it could be a early round VC, maybe it was someone that came in, friends and family, you know, your father-in-law lent you $100,000 to start the company, and that's now worth $9 million. And, you know, he wants to sell those shares. So the shareholders can come from all different directions, but oftentimes they want to sell away from a structured company-sponsored program. They just want to sell their shares. And so they come to us, and that's their block market. But your question is a really interesting one, because you think about how the venture capital sort of business model works. Is venture capitalists invest in private companies. Those companies grow and succeed, and then they have an exit. What does an exit look like? Well, sometimes it's an IPO. Sometimes it's M&A. But something happens to that private company to create liquidity. Well, in this market, Simon, that we are in right now, those exits aren't happening. Everyone knows the IPO market has been closed for the better part of the last year and a half, and frankly, you know, there's not a lot of signs on the horizon that that's changing anytime soon. M&A is at the lowest level in close to a decade. So if venture capitalists can't have those exits, then their investors, their limited partner investors, can't get distributions of cash back. And how it works is, you know, LPs typically get those distributions and then they reinvest them with their venture capital. So it's a sort of a virtual cycle, but it's all dependent on exits. And those exits aren't happening. And so the machine sort of grinds to a halt. So venture capitalists, in order for their business models to function, really need liquidity. And if M&A is not happening and IPOs aren't happening, then second market liquidity is kind of the only game in town. And so I think that's pretty much the most active part of our business right now, is working with venture capitalists to create liquidity in their portfolios.
So I would have expected, given the enormous opportunity set on your doorstep, you'd just be in the US. But you told me in our earlier conversation that you've already brought on board quite a few UK bodies and some others. So tell me about your geographical thinking.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the private markets, because they are by and large an unregulated space, have the potential to be, I think, maybe second only to FX as one of the true global asset classes. You know, with public market securities, you've got country-specific regulation that prevents stocks from trading from one exchange in one country to another. You know, you can't take a company listed on the DAX and just naturally list it on some other exchange. There's securities laws that prevent that. Well, that doesn't exist in the private markets. And unicorns, I think the number is something like a third of unicorns are outside the US. I mean, the majority of unicorns are in the US, but it's becoming a global market and that's changing. And you're seeing huge innovation coming from places like Israel, where I was last week, in India and China, the largest private company in the world right now is ByteDance. You know, that's the owner of TikTok. So it truly is a global market. We have a lot of clients and company clients that are in the UK, that are in Canada, various places around Europe. So I do think that, and even Latin America is starting to evolve. Places like Brazil and Mexico, you're starting to see some decent activity. So it is another one of our ambitions, again, without the sort of barrier of the public market securities regulation, that to the degree our technology can connect these pools of global private market capital, you can really create this true global asset class. So we're super excited about that.
And when you meet resistance or objections or uncertainty, in what form are they found?
That's a great question, because I think there has been a mind shift on the whole topic of liquidity in private markets. And let me talk about what that might look like. I think the old school Sand Hill Road venture capital view of secondary market liquidity, it's a bad thing. Hey, I'm investing in a private company and you cash out when I cash out. And if that's 14 years, then so be it. But you shouldn't be getting liquidity and taking chips off the table before I do. I think that's the old school way of thinking. And so I think the old school VCs were very much against private market liquidity. I think there's been a real evolution on that. Again, it's not, you know, reasonable to expect employees to wait 14 years to get liquidity. So I think that that's changing, but there still is some resistance there. I think from private companies, a lot, I wouldn't say a lot, but there still are private companies that are very hostile to the idea of offering liquidity to their employees. Because again, hey, we give our employees shares in companies as a retention tool. We don't want them selling them because we want them to be sort of tethered to the company. Again, I think that mindset is shifting. You know, if you're going to attract and retain employees, you need to offer these kind of liquidity programs. So I think there's sort of an old school perspective on all of this, and there's sort of a new way of thinking about it. I think this whole idea of the reality that you need to create liquidity in private market securities is something that's becoming much more mainstream. I think for investors, listen, there is a natural risk and illiquidity that goes along in investing in private company shares. You don't have the disclosures that you have in public shares. Obviously, public companies need to do, you know, quarterly earnings reports and regulatory filings. And for any public company, you know an awful lot about that business. And that's how the regulators designed it. Well, we don't have those rules in the private companies. So you have less liquidity, you have less information, and you have more risk. So there are inherent risks to investing in private company shares, which is why You know, the regulations are such that you need to be sort of what we call an accredited investor. These are not investments for mom and pop, small, unsophisticated investors. They regulators want you to have a degree of sophistication to buy these shares. But what does it mean for a company to be 14 years before they IPO? Well, when companies are IPOing now, because they're waiting so long, Simon, they're largely fully valued. These are large, mature companies by the time they IPO. And, you know, every investor wants to invest in a company at that hyper growth phase. You know, you want to buy a company when they're growing 30, 40, 50% a year. And because companies wait so long to go public now, if you want to invest and sort of realize those hyper growth returns, you're forced into the private markets. And so that's why we're so focused on removing this inefficiency, removing this friction to make it easier for people to buy and invest in companies when you want to be investing, which is when they're in that hyper growth phase. Because if you wait till they IPO, it's probably too late.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. We then discussed TPG's new fund, TPG Next, which targets underrepresented talent in the investment industry, including its partnership with Harlem Capital Partners. Joining me was Pamela Pavkov, partner and head of TPG Next, and Anil Vasquez Ubari, TPG's COO. So it looks to me as this has been a combination of organic and inorganic, because in 2019, TPG acquired the Harlem Capital Partners. So just tell me what that did and what that gave you. And you know, integration can be tricky affairs. So I'd like to understand a little bit about how you have made that work.
The Harlem Capital in 2019 was our first investment of our balance sheet. It was a seeding investment. When we met Henri and Jared, they had raised $4 million through their own network. They had been hard at fundraising for a while. I had known them for a few years back, and I saw something powerful in them. They had a lot of conviction. They had worked together for a long time, even though they were very young. And they had purpose in what they were building. They knew where they wanted to go. And so we went through our underwriting process with them and decided that we were ready to invest in them. And sure enough, they closed their first fund a few months after that at their hard cap of the $40 million range. And they've raised their second fund at $134 million. So immense growth. And exactly what you would want to prove in this strategy, that if you give the acceleration capital and you become a strategic partner with these managers, everyone's going to do better. And the companies that they're investing in, the portfolio and the network that they're creating is also diverse in and of itself, even though we don't require our managers in Next to invest exclusively in diverse companies, just by nature of their networks and who they attract. That is true as well. So it has a multiplier effect, not only on the capital allocator seat, but also in terms of diversifying the entrepreneurial ecosystem that is so important for growth in this industry.
And also, I note that within your portfolio companies, I think there are 400 positions that you have implemented at board levels. Now, just that can be tricky because there's an imposition at some point of established entities and owners that do things their way, and there's a higher set of objectives or a set of objectives that you have. How does that balance work between push and acceptance?
Yeah, and I'll give maybe, but I think Pamela should tell her philosophy that we've developed. I mean, they are the owners of these firms. That's the whole purpose of TPG Next. We are trying to create new owners of firms that are going to be multi-generational firms, hopefully, multi-funds. They'll grow their strategy. We are there to be their strategic partners. And we do bring expertise, advice. We've learned from our own mistakes as well. We have relationships on the fundraising side and a full house of internal capabilities that are at their disposal. But as I mentioned at the beginning, is to give birth and to grow the firm that they want to lead. And so there are things that are important to us in terms of core values of that firm and the culture, and obviously in terms of them being commercial enterprises. But the strategy and the ownership and the leadership resides with the managers. Pamela, do you agree?
Yeah, fully. And this was actually a key area of discussion for us as we were contemplating Next 2.0. And I think the observation we've had that's only been underscored by our pipeline activity is that there is an exceptionally high volume of really talented principals who happen to be underrepresented, but are first and foremost really exceptional investors and leaders of their own businesses. And so we're looking to empower them to execute and give them guidance and support to help de-risk their firm growth and development, leveraging our 30-year history as a firm of building new investment businesses. But these are, as Ani Lu says, their businesses, not ours. And we want to invest in them on account of their demographic attributes, but we believe in them because of the skill set that they've cultivated throughout their careers as successful investors and executives.
So just tell me a little bit about how large you want it to be, because too much in the way of assets might just simply mean you're stretching too far to find, you know, suitable investments.
We think Next has the potential to grow into quite a large platform, but we're seeking to balance that scale with value add. We have been exceptionally helpful and available to our balance sheet managers, and we want to have that reputation with all of the managers we back through Next, where we are easily available and truly value add on the business building pieces of our role as their strategic partner. And that becomes increasingly difficult to do if you're spread across too many relationships. So where we intend to actually focus developing scale is by pursuing multiple transaction types with the same GPs. So investing with them across several funds, co-investing with them, pursuing secondary purchases with them, really helping deepen the relationship and knowledge across a much longer term relationship with the same set of principals.
And can you give me maybe one or two examples? And I think that would help listeners as well understand the types of investments that you've executed.
Yeah, so we have not activated the fund. Both of our balance sheet investments were venture capital investments that consisted of seeding relationships, meaning having ownership interests in the GP itself, making primary fund commitments, as well as co-investment in the case of Amos Ventures. So we intend to pursue all three of those transaction types, plus secondaries through the fund. And with respect to asset class, TPG Next's fund will invest not just in venture capital, but also growth equity, buyout, and credit.
Next, we spoke with Mathieu Chabrin, co-founder of Tigaho Capital, about the entrepreneurial partnership approach Tigaho have adopted to develop their very successful growth strategies. So maybe just help everybody understand the firm's mission and vision today.
So today, I'm not saying it's a bit easier than it was, you know, almost 20 years ago, but scale and reach matters. We've been lucky in the sense that when we started, or even 10 years ago, the alternative asset managers maybe were not as well identified as they are today. Remember, you know, shadow banking, you know, 10 years ago. Alternative was very much about, you know, the hedge fund format. Not digging into history, but remember what happened during the GFC, you know, around, you know, the securitization. Fast forward 2023, with the GFC in the middle, with this all interest rates, monetary policy situation we've been going through for the past 10 years, all of a sudden, alternative asset managers are well identified as a legitimate source of capital, be debt or equity, even real assets when it comes to providing liquidity solution, in a market, in a financial market that has changed a lot. I mean, banks have changed a lot. Insurance companies have changed a lot. And so, particularly here in Europe, this asset class has emerged and is now a very well-identified and legitimate, both for investors, you know, we'll come back to that, but also for corporates and companies. So that's in itself is a very significant structural step. And what was originally a cyclical opportunity has become a structural, you know, a structural opportunity. So being now, as you said, you know, around, you know, 40 billion AUM, which clearly in Europe makes us, you know, a relevant platform. But at a global scale, today you have to reach to Asian investors, North American investors, Middle East investors. Many people in this industry, Simon, you know, are prepared to make money with someone else's money, but less so are prepared to make money with their kids' money, which is, I guess, the definition of an entrepreneur. That's what we've managed to develop, I guess, at TKO, having this partnership mentality, this partnership approach where people, you know, put a significant skin in the game. They write a check, you know, to join us, and it creates some kind of solidarity, you know, within partners, so that whenever we decide to launch secondary private credit in the US, to buy a REIT in Singapore, to be one of the pioneer in energy transition growth equity strategies in Europe, we put some real capital, and we need to have, you know, this this partners approach. So a lot of element, I might be digressing a bit, which are very interesting. Now, at this stage of our development, the industry has changed structurally. What we do remains effectively to provide capital and flexible capital to any given situations. And we are at a tipping point, certainly in Europe, to create for the next 10 years what will be, you know, the winning platform in this alternative, quote-unquote, manager landscape, because we'll be able to make a difference for, you know, for the years to come.
Do you have business partners as you enter into these transactions? I was interested that you've joined forces with Airbus, Safran, Thales, and the Dassault Group around aeronautical investment. How do you think about who and when and where?
Yeah, very good point you picked up on the corporate partners. If I step back a minute, the TKO journey, as we mentioned, you know, earlier, has been a real, you know, entrepreneurial story, where I wish I had, you know, reached out to global sovereign wealth funds 20 years ago to ask them for $1 billion. But when you're managing 4 million, it's a little bit of a challenge. So our growth and journey was fueled by private investors, families, family offices, some of them, you know, well organized, other much more, you know, entrepreneurial, who liked the ideas and the approach that what we're trying to develop was first and foremost, you know, our own business, and we're all in on that. So as I said, you know, they were seizing the opportunity to allocate to an asset class or a strategy they would not be offered otherwise. Then we got into the more financial and institutional landscape, insurance companies, retirement plan in Europe, and then in Asia, more recently, you know, in North America and the Middle East. And then came, you know, 5-6 years ago, some opportunities to team up with corporates. Because when you're in the money management business, the investment management business, very often people are trying to grab what I would call, not being judgmental, you know, passive capital that are looking for a manager to help them deploy. And then we started discussing with very active, obviously smart, but active and nimble capital, the corporate capital, who's looking at deploying to some blind spot of what they would be doing otherwise in their industrial businesses, and create some leverage with partners like us, an asset manager, to give them access to things they would not see otherwise. So we started effectively with on the energy transition. We were fairly early in the energy transition in 2017, 18, I guess. Now it has become very much, you know, bread and butter, but at the time, I think it was relatively forward-looking. And we teamed up with Total Energy, global energy company, who said, okay, you guys are seeing stuff, you know, we might not be focusing on. Obviously, they might be seeing it, but not focused because of the scale. And so they started, you know, we started together a fund, an energy transition fund, a decarbonization fund, focusing on profitable, mid-market, growing company who needed some capital in to scale and massify the solution they had. We raised $1.2 billion for a first-time strategy, first-time fund, first-time partnership. And the partnership with them, what they bring at the corporate, beyond the capital, you know, the reach, as you can imagine, of this platform has been a real game changer. I mean, today we've got obviously many competitive solution, you know, in the market, but we're about to raise, you know, vintage number two, and I'm expecting that to, you know, to be a real success. Then we replicated that, to your point, with the aerospace, defense, and cybersecurity landscape with Airbus, Dassault, Thales, Safran, you know, in the middle of COVID when there was a great opportunity to help restructure the aerospace industry. Same thing, you know, they invested 200 million euros. We invested 230 million euros from our own balance sheet. Again, the skin in the game. We had the team led by our partner, you know, Marwan Laoud, who was running, you know, Airbus, you know, for a long time. And so we knew we had, you know, a differentiating angle to then go and raise what is now $1 billion plus, you know, fund. More recently, in the regenerative agriculture space, don't tell anyone, I know nothing about that personally, but we know how to bring people, skill set, knowledge, expertise. We teamed up with Unilever under the leadership of my partner, Cécile Cabanis, who had, you know, worked for 20 years at Danone. And so we put together the asset management toolbox, TKO, the reach into a global investor pool. We bring the expertise, we put the team together, and here you've got a very differentiating, you know, proposal. So that's kind of how we've been approaching not only raising third-party, as I call it, you know, passive capital, but this very active capital. And by putting all that together, you can tell a differentiating story. And I guess, you know, in the current environment, that's what investors are looking for, a differentiating story.
Well, I hope you're enjoying the show so far. We'll be back shortly after a few quick words from our sponsor. The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below. Finally, sat with Matt Brown, founder, CEO, and chairman of Case. He discussed the remarkable scale of capital that US financial advisors advise on and the continued opportunities to bridge that community with those who create the alternative products. How do you quantify that market opportunity?
You know, just to give you some numbers to hang on to, U.S. wealth management, meaning the amount of capital that financial advisors in America alone advise on, is north of $40 trillion. By 2030, that's expected to be close to $60 trillion. To put that in perspective globally, if you were to add up the 10 largest wealth countries, excluding Japan, that would still be smaller than the U.S. So the U.S. market is quite untapped. As you know, institutional allocations to alternative investments, not our market, but the institutional world, typically are between 40 and 50%. And that's across, of course, private equity, private credit, venture, all real estate strategies, and all hedge fund strategies. In U.S. wealth management, the average allocation to alternative investments on average is north of just around 5%. There's a tremendous amount of room to grow. If you channelize U.S. wealth management between the largest firms, the UBS, the Morgan Stanley, the Merrill Lynch's of the world, JP Morgan's, their average is around 15%. And the independent wealth community where we participate, which controls half the market of that $40 trillion, is less than 2%. So if you look at it, there's a lot of room to grow here. And that's why you see these asset managers like, you know, Apollo and Ares and KKR and Blackstone and Carlyle and many, many others so laser focused on wealth management, because it really is, from a growth standpoint, the biggest opportunity for them to increase their shareholder base.
Yeah, and we've had a few of them on the show, which has been really interesting to sort of, you know, to uncover their whole sort of drive. Now, I'm going to quote you. You said technology is suited to solve the problem of unequal access to financial services. And I'd love you just to explain that.
So technology allows Case and other platforms to do a variety of things in a scalable way. So financial advisors, by structure, are, you know, distributed across the United States in every city. They have very busy schedules taking care of their clients' needs. So what we have to be able to do effectively is deliver information about the different funds and strategies so they can learn about them, how to implement them, and how to talk to their clients about alternative investments, especially those who have never invested in alternative investments before. But it has to be done in a scalable and repeatable way. You can't just get on a plane and knock on a door and have one conversation, then have another conversation. You're never going to get the job done of mass adoption. So through our technology platform, which advisors can log into, they can learn about all the different funds and strategies and how to implement. So first thing that technology does for Case is it allows us to scale information broadly and quickly and make it accessible. The second thing that our technology allows for is efficient execution of transactions in alternatives. Historically, alternative investments are designed for large institutions. There's a lot of paperwork. Subscription documents can be hundreds of pages. But imagine if you're trying to get hundreds of your clients in small denominations into alternative investments. That means you have to actually do that paperwork manually, get manual signatures. It just, the system breaks. So what our technology does is it's digitized that entire process and turns what can be hours of work into seconds, allowing for a quick execution. And then lastly, and most importantly, it's not just good enough to give access and education to alternative investments, but you really need to manage them once you own them. There's capital calls, there's reporting requirements, there's taxation documentation. So we centralize all of what we call the post-trade experience on the platform. And our ability to send data and information anywhere makes the advisor's life very easy. So our technology allows the pre-trade, education, trade, execution, and post-trade coordination to be scalable and very efficient for the financial advisor.
And are you as an institution product neutral, by which I mean some advisors might lean into real estate or hedge funds? So is that how you think about it? Yours is merely a mission to put pipes between these two entities.
Yeah, that's correct. We don't take a view. Case is not an advisor to advisors. We don't recommend product. We are the marketplace where they go shopping. You know, if you and I owned a grocery store together, you know, we would sit back and we would think about how do we stock the food on the shelves? And it wouldn't start with because you had a good idea. It would start with because we would say, what did the clients want to see on our shelves? You know, so we use a lot of market testing, a lot of surveying, a lot of ability to reach out to the audience and understand where trends are going. We also have a strategic partnership with Mercer. I'll talk about that in a second. But our platform really, or the shelves of our store, are stocked with a wide variety of different strategies from, as I mentioned, all types of private markets and also hedge fund strategies.
So what intrigued me when I was doing my research ahead of this is that the management consultant Bain had made the point that there is little brand recognition in the alternative space, which sort of surprised me, but I think that's maybe because if one's in it every day, one is aware of that. How is that changing, and what's your view 5 years hence?
Well, this is a huge topic that you bring up, which is brand and market share. And you're absolutely correct. We talk about the names of the asset managers, and I think that's what you're referring to, you know, as known commodities, as known firms, because we are in the industry. But the alternative investment community at large is not known by name. Yes, at the very top of the pyramid, a few that end up in the Wall Street Journal on a regular basis. But broadly speaking, most alternative investment managers by name are not recognized in the wealth management community. So what's happening is that there's a lot of investment by these firms to get branding in the channel, get the recognition they need in the channel, and earn that market share and that brand loyalty. And that's happening. Any firm that wants to compete in wealth management, or as we say at Case, anyone who wants to win in wealth, needs to invest in their brand. And it's happening. And they're making, you know, they're making strides. But the flip side of that coin is also quite interesting, which is that because most are not known, it's a bit of a level playing field for anyone who wants to establish brand. You know, we would think, well, of course, the biggest names in the industry have a huge advantage on day one. And there is an advantage to size and track record and, you know, being somewhat known. But there is still an opportunity for many, many firms, European firms, international firms, and US firms that are under the radar right now from a brand standpoint to invest in their brand and earn market share. There's been multiple examples of firms that we've put on our platform, asset management firms, that are not known to the wealth community, but over the last 5 and 10 years, they've become some of the most prolific known brands in wealth just as a result of that exposure.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.